Rachel. I'm an alcoholic. And thank you very much for asking me to speak, Billy. It really is a privilege, I feel, to try to carry the message to another alcoholic today. And so I'm really happy to be here. And this is a very welcoming group. And it's just nice to be with you all and to be sober today. And to have a nice dinner with friends beforehand. And just feel very blessed today. I am very blessed today. So I guess with that, I'm going to tell you in a general way what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. I grew up in the Washington, D.C. area, and I grew up in a good family, and I was always given anything I needed and wanted. And I grew up with an older sister who was like 2 years older than me, and I had a pretty normal childhood. You know, I played sports, I had friends, I did well in school, and, you know, like, I had good aspirations to be a good person, and I was, like, a brownie and a Girl Scout, and, you know, like, I was a good kid. And, I remember, too, from a young age always being drawn to alcohol, and there was always alcohol in my house, and my parents were social drinkers. Think that either I'm an alcoholic, but there was always alcohol around, and I would see them occasionally with their friends drinking, and just thought, you know, like, that's what adults do to have fun. That looks really fun. And my dad would give me sips occasionally of his beer or wine, and I always loved it. And I had this strange fascination with it, and just loved the smell and the taste and the bottles and the way it looked. And but to me, this seemed normal. You know, even from a young age, I didn't know there was anything abnormal about that. And I just thought that's what people did for fun, you know. And so from a pretty young age, I think I was about 13 when my older sister started getting into a lot of trouble with drinking and drugs. And there was a lot of chaos going on in my family. And she sort of always got the attention, even though a lot of it was negative attention. And I sort of was like the quiet one on the side. And so she started drinking and doing drugs and, like, really kept it from me. I think she, like, wanted to protect me. And so at first I was really angry and didn't really know what was going on. And I started getting kind of rebellious and, like, cheating at school, even though I didn't really need to. And, like, dyeing my hair black and shoplifting and just very rebellious. And I started drinking. I would, I had one friend who would drink with me. We would, like, the first time we walked over a mile to this convenience store one Saturday afternoon and asked a homeless person to buy us some alcohol. I don't know where I got this idea. Probably maybe from my sister, I don't know. But we found this guy to buy us some malt liquor, I think, and we got it and walked back and hid it in the bushes and waited till my parents were asleep and snuck out and got it. And my friend got really drunk. She got into my parents' whiskey and got sick all over the place. And but I didn't care. I cleaned it up and thought, you know, I'll just have to be a little more careful next time. But that was fun. I want to do that again, you know. And at this point, too, I just switched schools to an all-girls middle school. And a lot of my friends there, I had a couple friends who I'd been friends with before I went there. And a lot of them started questioning me, you know, like, what are you up to? What's this drinking? You know, and I think a lot of them were concerned, and I just said, you know, who needs you? And moved on to my friends who were interested in drinking. So I paid consequences from the very beginning, too. You know, I sacrificed those friendships for alcohol. And so I had a couple friends who I would drink with on weekends, and one other friend whose parents were pretty absent. You know, they weren't around a lot, and we would drink vodka at her house, and I remember blacking out for the first time there, and again, not thinking it was abnormal, you know. I thought, that was a little strange, but, like, didn't think that didn't happen to everyone, you know. And because I remember waking up in the next day and seeing this mud all over my shoes, and I had no idea how it got in there. I didn't even remember leaving the house. And just thought, oh, that's kind of weird, but sort of shrugged it off, and continued like that and drank on weekends, but still showed up to school and did well in school. So I tried to maintain that outside, you know, like from the outside, I tried to keep up the to look that things were okay. And when I got into high school, I switched schools to this smaller kind of artsy school, and fell right in with the drinking crowd. You know, like the first week of school, was invited to a party with the sophomores, and just thought that was great. And I remember making up this lie to my parents to go to this party, and told them I was going to a movie or something. And I went to this guy's house. His parents were out of town, and you know, on the way in the door, I got handed a 40-ounce of malt liquor and drank most of it. And I don't remember a lot of the night, but I remember getting thrown in the shower and not being able to find my clothes later. And then, but just thinking it was really fun. You know, I felt like when I drank, it was like I didn't care what you thought of me. I didn't care what I said. And I felt like I could be the life of the party. And so it continued like that through high school. I got a boyfriend, and around that time I was 16 and I got sent to my first AA meeting because I was visiting my sister in college, and I got caught drinking underage at a bar. An undercover cop sat down next to me and flashed his badge at me, and so I had to go to 3 AA meetings. And I remember those meetings, I didn't see any young people, and I just thought I had to write a one-page response to those meetings. And I remember writing, I don't need to go to AA because I'm not an alcoholic. And I just immediately related out. I thought, I'm too young, these people are all older, and they just sound really depressed, I don't need this, you know? And I don't know if that's really what I heard, but my perception, you know, like that's what I took out of it. And and I remember running out of the room as they were holding hands to say a prayer because it just freaked me out. I just thought, what are they doing? And so I continued drinking, and that boyfriend broke up with me and started dating my best friend. And you know, these things happen, but I reacted very severely to this. She lied to me about it for a while, and I found out through other people, and it just became this huge drama, and I was very angry, and I turned to alcohol, and my drinking really took off. I started drinking a lot more, and I became even more out of control. I would have parties when my parents were out of town, and, you know, they never knew what state their house would be in when they got home, and I didn't care, you know, like, that's how I made friends. I had a fake ID, so I'd buy really cheap beer and invite friends over and, you know, like, buy the good imported beer for myself. And, like, I always had my cord, you know? And I always made sure I had enough. And so I was doing this, and at this point I was really out of control. You know, like, I started getting violent sometimes, and I was throwing myself at different men, and I didn't care. You know, I really didn't care. And I started having those feelings of guilt and remorse and shame the next morning when I'd wake up, you know, about the person I was becoming and the things I was doing. And but the only thing that made that feeling any better was drinking more. And so I would plan my weekends, and I couldn't wait. It got to the point where the week at school was so miserable and unbearable that all I lived for was to drink on weekends, really. And so, at that point, I remember one time going with the seniors when I was a junior in high school because I had to switch groups of friends after the whole boyfriend incident, and I went to Beach Week with the seniors, which is basically a week where all the kids go to the beach together and drink all week. And I convinced my mom to rent this house for us, and promptly stocked it with tons of alcohol and beer, and I don't think my friends ever paid their portion to my mom for that house. And I got there, and I don't remember a lot of it, but I remember people being really mad at me all weekend and worried about me, and I had no idea why, because I think I was in a blackout most of the weekend. But I have these flash memories of, like, coming out of a blackout, slapping someone I didn't know, or, like, stealing someone's clothes. Like, just these flash in and out of blackouts. And then friends saying, are you okay? Like, what's wrong with you? Like, you're a little out of control. And I just thought, leave me alone, let me drink, I'm fine, you know? And so my mom came to see us, and she walked into this house, disgusting, full of alcohol. Her daughter at like 3 in the afternoon, so hungover that I could hardly walk, you know. And this is what my mother was walking into, her youngest daughter. And I didn't care, you know, I really didn't. So I managed to get through the next year of school somehow and graduated. I was planning on, I decided to go to school out of state. I thought that maybe that would fix me. You know, I would relocate, make a new start, make new friends, not drink as much, you know, like try to get back on my feet. The only problem was that I had decided to go to school in New Orleans. Which is really not a good place to try to control your drinking. But first, that summer, I got a job working at a pastry shop in Georgetown, and I remember showing up to work, hungover, reeking of alcohol, my boss sending me home. You know, this happened a couple times, and then I planned this trip to Amsterdam because I wanted to have, like, a last hurrah before I went off and made my new start. And so I dragged one of my friends with me, because people were not jumping at the opportunity to go with me to Amsterdam. I think they were afraid, because you never knew what would happen partying with me, really. So I convinced my friend to come. I think I paid for her airfare so she'd come with me. We arrived in Amsterdam with no place to stay, and I immediately found the cheapest youth hostel I could find so I could spend all my money on alcohol. The conditions we were in were pretty disgusting. there were like 8 bunk beds of like all these random people from all over the country, all over the world, and sharing one little bathroom. Once again, I didn't care. You know, I did a lot of damage with that friendship. Our second night there, I left my friend at a bar to go chase a guy. You know, to go home with this guy. And I didn't even think twice. You know, I said, "I'll see you later. This is what I'm doing." And didn't understand why she was mad at me the next day. This was the person I had become. I had no care for anybody else. All I cared about was what I wanted to do and my next drink. And if you got in the way, you know, that's too bad. So I was drinking every day. There was, a beer vending machine in our lobby of our hostel. And I just thought that was great. There's another story I forgot to tell about the last boyfriend I had. I convinced my parents, this was before Amsterdam, I had convinced my parents to let me have this party at my house for 100 days left until we graduate high school. And I got really drunk, it was one of those nights again where I was in and out of blackout. I remember my boyfriend wasn't there, but I remember messing around with another guy, and then it got back to him the next morning. And he came over the next morning, and I was so hungover, I was throwing up in the bathroom. And I just remember him looking down at me with that look of, "What the hell is wrong with you?" That look of disgust. And that was what it says in the book, I felt, the pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. That's where I was. It just got worse from there. Like, after that was Amsterdam, and I got back from Amsterdam, and the next day I was in New Orleans for my freshman college orientation, and with 1,600 incoming freshmen, and I was trying to not drink. And the first night there, I went out to dinner with my parents, and it started with one glass of wine with my parents, you know, harmless. But I didn't know that I am an alcoholic, and that once that phenomenon of craving kicks in, one drink is not enough. I don't know what I was thinking, because I never had one drink. You know, from the beginning, I drank to get drunk. I never drank just one, really. I didn't see the point. And so I don't know what I was thinking trying to do this, but you know, that night, nothing terrible happened, but I was found myself in the exact same place I had always been, you know, following some people down Bourbon Street for more alcohol, and going drink for drink with another guy at a bar and drunk once again. And it scared me because everything in me was like, I'm not going to get drunk tonight. And I did it anyway. And so my parents left, and I was, in my dorm room, and I pretty much hid in my dorm room a lot. I was having panic attacks, and I couldn't talk to people. I was having these hysterical crying fits and having to run back to my dorm room and just, hide. And I knew that if I took a drink that it would calm me down a little bit, but I was terrified of what would happen because I was with so many people I didn't know. So what was to be my last drink, I didn't know it, I didn't plan it, but the girls on my floor took me out. They said, "It looks like you need a drink, come with us." And we bought some vodka and went in another girl's room, and I was the girl who, we were drinking screwdrivers, and we ran out of orange juice, and I was, pouring the Kool-Aid packets into the vodka, and probably towards the end just drinking the vodka straight, and nothing dramatic happened that night. I just went in my room and passed out in my dorm room, and I think the next day I had seen psychiatrists before, but I had never given them a chance, really, and I thought that maybe that could fix me. I thought, maybe I'm just crazy. I don't know what is wrong with me, but I cannot bear this, and because the thought of living with or without alcohol was unbearable. I couldn't picture either way. And so the next day I made an appointment with a psychiatrist on campus, and I remember the night before the appointment I was trying to sleep, and I was just, listening to some music on my headphones and trying to sleep and just thinking, like, I don't know if I can go on. And I was having suicidal thoughts. I really just thought, I don't know if I can go on. And then I said the first honest prayer that I had said, it's probably since I was a little girl, and I said, "God, please help me," because I was out of answers. I did not know what to do, and some part of me wanted to live because I didn't have to take my life. And the next morning, I made it to that appointment, and I don't remember what I said, but I told him what was going on, and he asked me, "Have you had any suicidal thoughts?" And I was honest. I said yes, and so I was sent to the psych ward from there, and I was in the adult unit because I had just turned 18, and I was with people who were getting shock therapy, and I just thought, I don't belong here, but I'm going through a rough phase, I'm just going to get back on my feet. But I was there, and I remember having to call my mom from the psychiatrist's office to tell her, I'm going into the hospital, and I can't imagine the pain my parents went through hearing that their youngest daughter was suicidal and had to be hospitalized. And I don't have children, but I can't even imagine the pain they must have gone through. And they, I'm sure, wanted to come to me immediately and take me, but they let me make a decision of what I wanted to do. And so I was there for about 2 weeks, and I don't remember a lot of it, but I remember being put on some medication and meeting with doctors, and finally decided to withdraw from Tulane at the college in New Orleans and go back home to D.C. with my parents. And so I did that, and I remember when I was leaving, they suggested that I go to N.A. or A.A. And so my parents came and got me, and I flew back to D.C., and I was still in touch with some of my old friends, although most of them were not jumping at the opportunity to see me, especially when they heard I wasn't drinking anymore, because I had surrounded myself with people who all they wanted to do was drink. And so so I finally called AA after a week being home. I didn't pick up a drink somehow, and I really think it's the grace of God, It is the grace of God that led me to AA, because I think after that prayer I said that night, I was led to AA by a series of circumstances. I certainly did not wake up one morning and say, I need to go to AA, that's going to fix me, you know? And even then I thought, okay, I'll go to this meeting. I don't know what it's going to do for me, but I might as well check it out. And so I went to a meeting, and I asked for a young people's meeting because I had drank with a girl who had been sober in what's now my home group, and she couldn't stay sober. But she had told us some about these conferences she'd been to, and so I asked for a young people's meeting, and I went. It was a Friday night, and I was living in Northwest D.C., and they told me about a meeting that was about just like 20 minutes away, and I thought, oh, I guess I'll drive the whole 20 minutes to this meeting. It seems so far to me, you know? And so I drove to this meeting 20 minutes away, and, you know, nowadays I drive, you know, a couple hours back and forth within a day, and don't think much of it. But that's how small my world was, you know? I thought, okay, I'll drive the 20 minutes, and I went and was immediately greeted with open arms at this meeting, and people seemed genuinely happy to see me. They asked me how long I've been sober, what, you know, do you have a sponsor? And I didn't even really know what a sponsor was at this point. But there was a conference that weekend, so the meeting was a little bit smaller, and a lot of people were going after the meeting to this conference called Sessions by the Sea in Ocean City. And in fact, they all invited me to this conference. They said, you can ride with us, you can stay with this person at their beach house. And I just made up something, like, oh, I have plans, I can't. I'm sure I didn't, but these two girls, thank God, were practicing the 12th step, and they reached out to me, they got my phone number, and they called me the next day from the beach, and they told me the meeting to go to that night, and I went. I don't think I talked to anyone, but I went, and they told me about Midtown on Sunday, and I went to that meeting, and one of the girls told me, I think she kind of assigned herself as my sponsor. I didn't even know what that was, but she said, you know, you have to meet so-and-so. Tell them you're my pigeon. And I was like, what? What are you talking about? I had no idea what she was talking about. And but so she told me to meet her at this coffee shop at 7. I don't think she thought I would show up because she came about 10 or 15 minutes late. But I was there. I came. And we went to that meeting, and I picked up my 24-hour chip there. And and I don't remember a lot of it, but I remember people coming up to me and talking to me and welcoming me. And these people just kept calling me. And so I kept going to meetings, even though I wasn't sure. I really wasn't sure if AA was for me or if I really was an alcoholic. I thought for a while that maybe I'm just depressed with maybe a drinking problem, and that if I, you know, can get my drinking under control, that, or if I get my depression under control and, you know, circumstances change in my life, that, you know, that I'll be okay and be able to drink normally. And I had no idea. So I kept going to meetings, and I eventually did ask another woman to be my sponsor, and I just started getting involved in doing service at the meetings pretty quickly. You know, and that really saved me, because it took a while for me to take a real interest in personal recovery. You know, for a while I sort of floated on the fellowship and the service. But I started going through the steps with my sponsor, and started reading the big book with her, and things took a little while to get better with my parents. Because at first I thought, you know, I'm sober now, you know, things should be great. But I was still kind of living the same way I had been living, drinking. I was still going out late with people for meetings. They didn't know where I was most of the time. And I wasn't in school or working. And, you know, they, I think at first were like, what is this AA? It doesn't really seem to be helping her much. But slowly, you know, I eventually did go back to school after a year sober. And in that first year, we were just talking about the play that our home group does on New Year's Eve. I was privileged to be able to get involved with that really early on, because I started coming to meetings in early October, and they were starting up doing the play sets for the play. And I was able to get involved right away. They did it every weekend then, on Saturdays and Sundays at someone's house. We would paint all the backdrops and the props. And I showed up every weekend because I had nothing else going on, really. And I loved it. And I remember that New Year's Eve, you know, sitting in the audience watching these things. I spent hours and hours on painting. And just getting a glimpse of becoming part of something bigger than myself, which I had never really experienced before. And I had no thought of, what are my old friends doing? Should I be drinking tonight? Because, you know, New Year's is a big drinking night. And I didn't even think about it that night. No thought. And I was surrounded by friends. And it was really powerful. And it's just grown from there. And I have a sense of belonging today that I never knew before. And I never knew it was possible. And so I went back to school and I started taking classes in architecture, which is something I've always been interested in. And I eventually transferred to a four-year university and got my degree and then a master's degree. And I've been able to, like, really live out some dreams, things I've always wanted to do. And I moved in with sober people. I moved in with a couple of sober women. And that was such a joy to learn how to live with people and clean up after myself. And I did a fourth and fifth step with my sponsor. I think at first, the second step, like it says, the group was my higher power really at first, because I had really turned my back on God. Like I said, that prayer I said that night, I had really turned my back on God, because when I became so miserable during the end of my drinking, I thought, how can there be a God if I feel this horrible? And if there is, he certainly doesn't care anything about me, you know. And so slowly, you know, I mean, that the higher power thing took me a while, but I could see AA as a power greater than myself, and my home group as a power greater than myself. And I came to believe that if I did what they were doing, that my life could get better too. And I was able to get off my medication. It turned out that I didn't need it, and I know that's not everyone's experience, but it turns out that by working the 12 steps of AA, I'm not depressed today. You know, I certainly have bad days, for sure. You know, I'm certainly not happy every day by any means, but I do have some knowledge of joy today. You know, I have moments and days even of feeling joy. And so I did, like I said, I did a fourth and fifth step with that sponsor, and right after I celebrated a year, I switched sponsors again to the sponsor I have today. She's been my sponsor for 6 years now. I don't think I said it, but my sobriety date is November 30th of 1999. And so I did another fourth and fifth step with the sponsor I have today and started working with her. And I started doing some living events with my family slowly. You know, it was first like showing up for dinner with my parents weekly or sometimes every other week. And just taking an interest in my family's lives, you know, participating in their lives, which I never did before. I was too consumed with myself and my drinking and how bad I felt to care anything about other people. And so I started calling my sisters and trying to become a member of my family, and that's an ongoing process to this day. And then I was able to start sponsoring people. And that's, you know, it's been off and on, but through sponsoring people, I think the first one I sponsored for a while, I sponsored her for 3 years, and in her first year, her mother was diagnosed with cancer and passed away. And I was able to be there for her through that. And even though I didn't have experience with losing anyone, just being there for her and showing up for someone else and learning how to have a true care for someone else. Was such a gift, and because, like you heard, I didn't care about anyone before, and so I was able to start sponsoring people, and then the sixth and seventh step took a while for me. I felt like I sort of skipped over them at first, but then my sponsor started giving me more concrete things I could do. You know, she had me do writing on each particular defect, you know, like looking up the definition and writing the opposite, you know, trying to see how I could do the opposite of that defect. And that really helped, because I think at first steps six and seven seemed really like just this idea, and like I needed something concrete to kind of grasp onto. And so I have had some defects removed, but I need God's help. Even when they've been removed, I need to continue to ask for God's help to not act out on those defects. And I'm by no means perfect. And then I was able to go study in Europe during my junior year in college, and I lived in Barcelona for 4 months, and then I did a traveling semester all through Italy and France and Spain, and it was so amazing, and I always wanted to do that, and I never thought I could, but towards the end of that trip, even towards the middle, I started, it was my first time really being away from my home group, and I was not held accountable. There was no one there who knew me who would say, you know, like, have you been to a meeting? Have you taken inventory? And so I slowly kind of stopped doing as much as I had been doing when I was with my home group. And I didn't see it at first, but I was slowly, you know, stopping doing the things that had kept me sober and got me to the place where I had all those gifts in my life. And really, what happened was I slowly lost my primary purpose. I became very focused on, you know, look at all I've done. I should be able to do what I want here and have fun in Europe. Which, yeah, I am, but I started putting that ahead of my sobriety. And I was in a really dangerous spot. And I was going to bars sometimes and started having drinking thoughts. And really, I was about to drink again, and I didn't even know it. I was really complacent, you know, like it says, like being in danger and having no idea. I remember at one point I was with some classmates. They were passing around some red wine, and it was, smelled really strong. And I remember my mouth watering at the smell of it. And that really woke me up, because usually when I was around alcohol, I would recoil as if from a hot flame. And that really scared me. And so I was still in touch with my sponsor somewhat at this point. And so she started having me read the first step every night. You know, in the big book, I would read, alternate between reading more about alcoholism and the first step in the 12 and 12. And I started praying on my knees again every night, and I was able to come back from that trip. I didn't have to pick up a drink, and I came back, and I went through the steps again with my sponsor. And I've been back for, I guess, a couple years now, a year and a half, and I have more conviction today than I did before I left, you know. And although it was painful and uncomfortable a lot, I learned so much from that experience. You know, I learned that I have to practice these principles and do these steps wherever I am, regardless of my outside circumstances or whatever outside gifts I'm getting. And that I am an alcoholic, and if I don't do those things, I am going to head back towards the drink and drink again and probably die. And I think before I left, before I had that experience, I really was still kind of focused on, you know, what gifts am I getting, or doing these things so I would feel good, you know, like doing the steps so I'd feel good, and not really realizing to my core that I have to do these things so I don't drink again and die, you know. Because I think it's easy to get kind of distracted by, at least where I'm sober, you know, all these events and all this fun to be had sober, which is great, but, like, this is a serious disease, and I could die from it, really. And so I know that today, so I went through the steps again with my sponsor, and did some more direct amends with my family this year, which has been really cool, because up until then I hadn't really sat down with each of them and said, you know, face to face, this is what I did, I'm sorry. So I was able to do that with a couple of my sisters and my parents. And I sent a letter to that friend who I brought to Amsterdam with me. And I wanted to go up. She's living in New York now. I wanted to go up to do it face-to-face, but it didn't work out. But I talked to her briefly on the phone, and she sounded happy to hear from me. I think she probably thought I was going to New York and needed a place to stay. So we weren't able to meet up face-to-face, but I sent her this letter, and my side of the street is clean with that today. And it's such a relief, because I felt so, like, such a disgusting person when I got here. I really did. I felt like if you guys really knew how horrible I was, you would not want to come anywhere near me. And through working with the sponsor, I found that, and by confiding everything to that sponsor completely, with complete honesty, that I can use those experiences to help other people, you know, and I can help other people today. And like it says in the Ninth Step Promises, we will not regret the past nor wish to shut the door on it. And I have experienced a lot of the Ninth Step Promises. Fear of people and economic insecurity will leave us. You know, when I was new, in my first year, I did not speak. People would try to talk to me, and I would, you know, give one-word answers and just stare at my feet. And, you know, and I see newcomers like that today, and I feel them. I'm like, I know how you feel. Because I certainly didn't walk in here bounding in the door, you know, thinking, life is great, I'm sober, you know. It took a little while, and so I did more of those amends with my family, and it's just been such a joy, sobriety. What else am I missing? Today I live with sober people, too. I live with Lindsay, and she moved in at the best time because I just started my job. I just graduated in May, and I started working full-time at my first professional job, and I was having a really hard time getting up in the morning to do my reading and meditation for the 11th step. And I think part of it was that I had something going on in my life that I didn't want to see and face. That was part of it. But Lindsay moved in, and we started meditating in the mornings together, and it was wonderful because when I have that accountability, I will actually do it. And so, you know, like when someone else is looking, I'll actually do it. Sometimes that's what I need, you know. So on most mornings, we meet at like 7:15, and we read out of the books, the Daily Reflections and the Big Book and a couple other books, and we sit for, I'm shooting for 15 minutes now, but it's not always that long. But I really need that. I feel like I need that more than ever the longer I'm sober, because when I don't do that, I can still get all turned up inside and react to everything. And when I meditate, it's like it almost gives me like a buffer between me and the world. You know, like I don't have to react to everything as severely. And of course, I didn't start off doing 15 minutes. It started with like 2 minutes, and it's just built up from there. And I remember one time in particular when I was in school, we had to work really long hours in the studio for school. And at one point, I was there all night, and one of my classmates they were taking speed, and someone offered me some, and he's like, "Here, it'll just be on this table. I don't want it," and he left it on the table. And I didn't want it. I had no thought of wanting to take it, but I just remember having this reaction, like, "I can't be here. How can I have to finish my work, but I don't want to be here." And I had been practicing the 11 steps, so I went into a bathroom stall and meditated. And I think only because I had the practice of doing it, I was able to go in there and calm down and invite God back into my life and my night, my early morning, whatever it was. And I was able to go finish my work and not have to think about, you know, whatever was sitting on the table there. And I think I, like, moved to another area. But it's, like, really practical stuff, you know, tools for living. And prayer is the same way. And so that's been really cool. And And then just being able to sponsor people and try to carry this message to other alcoholics. That has to be my primary purpose today. And I forget it. I forget a lot, and I get distracted by other things. But thank God I have people like my sponsor and the other people that she sponsors to hold me accountable, you know, and call me out on stuff. And I think I'm close to out of what I want to say. I've never spoken for a whole hour, but I got pretty close. So, again, thank you so much for asking me. It's really a joy to be here. So, thank you. Thank you.